I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Aaron Harrell, Assistant Professor of Political Science at SUNY Geneseo. We're discussing his 2021 book, The Democratic Soul, Spinoza, Tocqueville, and Enlightened Theology, from the University of Pennsylvania Press. His research focuses on the American constitutional tradition, the political philosophy of the liberal enlightenment, and the thought of Alexis de Tocqueville. And his articles on these topics have appeared in major political science journals. Well, first of all, let me say, Aaron Harrell, welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Thank you very much for having me, Jeff.
Aaron, I love the book. It's a great analysis of two thinkers who aren't often put together, although maybe I'm forgetting a couple books, but Spinoza and Tocqueville. Very interesting results, you know, putting them together, both for the history of political theory, but also for the implications that you bring out for contemporary democracy and religion. So kudos for the book. Let me ask you, first of all, just tell us a little bit about the motivation for writing the book.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the motivation really does arise from just kind of looking at the precarious situation of modern democracy today, and especially as it pertains to questions of the relationship between democracy and religion, both in the narrow sense and in terms of church-state issues, but then just more broadly thinking about sort of the dissatisfactions that we feel today, there's a dissatisfaction that I think one can discern today with liberal democracy on both the left and the right, and we're living in an age where we're, you know, in fact, even, you know, much more so since I wrote the dissertation, which the book was based on, a kind of troubling distaste for liberalism and liberal democratic norms. And so I was thinking about the way, you know, trying to situate that kind of our vulnerabilities today within the larger sense of a kind of thinking about democratic morality and why that's seems to be dissatisfying to us. And then I ultimately kind of trace that back to this idea of, or this decline in the idea of devotion and of duties to something greater than oneself and self-sacrifice, and which ultimately connects very richly to these religious questions, and then bringing that back to our situation today, and then finding this that theme kind of pervading these two authors.
Yeah, that's good. I want to return certainly to the contemporary issues at the end, because I want to see, you know, sort of talk about Spinoza and Tocqueville first, and then see what kind of things they have to tell us about the contemporary era. I broadly understood the, you know, sort of motivation about the rise of illiberalism on the left and the right, and the sort of decline of liberalism to be able to engender a sense of common purpose or duty seems right on to me. Let me ask, I mean, just sort of as a way, you know, because a number of different political theorists, I guess, have sort of been trying to tackle these contemporary problems. But you look back to Spinoza and Tocqueville for, guidance. Maybe you could say just a little bit about why you chose those thinkers in particular.
Yeah, happy to. So let me start with Spinoza. So Spinoza is I think, one of the most interesting, of the early modern thinkers. He gives us the highest aiming version of liberal democracy. And therefore, I think articulates our greatest hopes for what liberal democracy is or what it could be, especially through a robust defense and an articulation of liberal democracy as a regime devoted primarily to freedom of speech and thought. So he sees, you know, from the title page of the Theological Political Treatise states that this regime is going to lead to the flourishing of philosophy. So he has really, you know, there's a high aim here. But at the same time, he also describes liberal democracy as although he doesn't use that term, but as a regime characterized by what we would call civic devotion or communal participation. So you've got rich intellectual life for the individual on the one hand, and even at the highest level, but also a kind of real civic civic dedication. He says that citizens in this regime, and he calls it the best regime, will not only agree not to do to another what they do not want done to themselves, to quote Hobbes's inverted golden rule, but also, he says, to defend another's right as their own. Another aspect of that is that Spinoza doesn't embrace the relativism that Hobbes and Locke embrace. Hobbes says there's no summum bonum or finis ultimus in human life, such as is spoken of in the books of the old moral philosophers. But this is, Spinoza, I think, shows himself to be one of those old moral philosophers, although he argues for the same kind of regime that Locke ultimately argued for, or a version of it. So Spinoza, I think, because he speaks to our dissatisfaction with liberal democracy, or in a way it promises us to sort of resources to remedy it. And Tocqueville.
Just as a follow-up on this, because just to clarify, because I was wondering, you're right, why Spinoza rather than say Hobbes or Locke as a sort of originary figure for liberalism. So is it that key point that you mentioned, that is, you know, and Hobbes and Locke do have these critiques of the ancient view, the summum bonum. You know, Hobbes takes as his lodestar the summum malum, that of death, sort of a negative aim, right? And so one of the worries, I take it, is that then the political regime doesn't have a kind of unity around a common human purpose, right? So whereas Spinoza, what you're suggesting he's offering is a common, you know, aspirational purpose for the best human life that sort of liberal democracy can provide. So is that the, you know, is that, that that's his contribution, as it were, to this?
He puts philosophy front and center, which is not something that the other early moderns seem to do. That Hobbes, you know, mentions philosophy. You know, it's a pleasure like other pleasures that one can pursue. You know, he certainly lived that way himself. But there's a real thoroughgoing defense in Spinoza of philosophy as the only true kind of freedom, and therefore the best way of life for a human being. He furthermore describes this liberal democratic regime as one whose very purpose will be to produce that way of life, and in which also perhaps more people can share in it than the classical authors might have thought. I'm not sure that would be Spinoza's final view, but he certainly gives that impression at least.
Yeah, so good, Tocqueville.
Tocqueville, I mean, similar, I think he speaks, Tocqueville also speaks to our dissatisfaction, but in a different way. I think first and foremost, I would say that Tocqueville is, in my opinion, certainly maybe the first thinker, but I think probably also the best thinker to analyze modern democracy simply on its own terms. Kind of just look at it. He doesn't start from the state of nature or any other kind of scientific abstraction. He just says, you know, let's look at politics. Let's come to America. Let's look at modern politics as it is. Look at the facts on the ground. Look at ordinary moral opinion and to take it seriously. I think he's been compared to Aristotle. I'm not saying that Tocqueville is Aristotle. They might have come to different conclusions, but I think they share a common approach that they just Tocqueville says that he at the end of his introduction that in writing the book he sought to see not differently but further than the parties. In other words, he what's I think remarkable about Tocqueville, in contrast to the early modern thinkers at least, and to in contrast to Spinoza, is that he took ordinary political opinion seriously, didn't dismiss it as mere rhetoric, but also on that basis tried to rise above it and or transcend it or as he says see further than it. The wrinkle there, though, is that unlike someone like Aristotle, who is examining it, what you could call ordinary pre-philosophic opinion, Tocqueville is analyzing a society that has been decisively shaped on a purportedly scientific basis, that's been shaped by the Enlightenment and by modern rationalism. So the ordinary opinions he's encountered are not exactly the same kind of ordinary opinions that Plato or Aristotle would have encountered. And then just to say a word about the two of them together, I think they both in a way help us understand the precarious situation of liberal democracy today, as I was saying, but also especially with a view to the religious question. I think that if you take them together, they help us, they provide some meditations on the big question about what exactly the relationship is between democracy and religion. So I could talk more about that, but I can stop there for now.
No, that's good. I mean, you know, in a sense that, I mean, I take it when you talk about the religious question, you mean not primarily a kind of question about, you know, constitutional law and balancing religious freedom and the needs of the community, but primarily about sort of basic fundamental existential needs of human beings that, you know, in some ways that say somebody like a Hobbes or a Locke don't, you know, sort of abstract from these fundamental religious needs. Is that right? Is that...
Yeah, absolutely. I think that their thought both speaks in a very deep and profound way to, you know, what is the psychology or the moral psychology that would lead us or not lead us to religious belief, and therefore what is the human situation? Do we need God to live and to have a successful political life as well? So there is the con law version of that is the narrow version, but I think they also help us meditate on the big questions of the politically relevant questions. You know, are democracy and religion, are they, you know, are do they harmonize or are they like oil and water? Is democracy friendly to Christianity and vice versa? Is Christianity a biblical religion hostile to democracy? I think Spinoza in particular, I think, shows us the theological origins of modernity or liberal democracy, the way that liberal democracy, in order to come into existence, I argue in the book, really did need to rewrite the Bible. And therefore, I think, you know, implicitly, Spinoza may show that the Bible may not be as friendly to liberalism as we might want it to be. And I think Tocqueville provides us a similar set of meditations, but arising from a reflection on political practice as he saw it, rather than on a reading of the Bible or anything like that. It's notable, I think, actually, just as an aside, that for all of Tocqueville's attention to religion, I don't believe that he ever actually cites the Bible, except for his chapter on the Puritans, where he quotes the Puritans themselves.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I too am interested in these sort of existential or grounding issues about liberalism. So one of these days, Aaron, I'll have to tempt you to the Germans, who I think provide the deepest of approach to this.
There's a linguistic difficulty there, I'm afraid.
That happens. Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about Spinoza, sort of dig more into Spinoza.
Yeah.
I thought maybe you could just start off by talking a little bit about the scholarship on Spinoza, in the sense that, you know, just like how Spinoza has been read by other scholars, and how you are, you know, sort of reading him in a distinct way, how you're contributing to how others are reading him.
Yeah, I think so. It's a good question. I think the main thing is so my book, and I make no apologies for this, that it's deeply indebted to Strauss in the way that he read Spinoza, and primarily in stressing, not only in reading Spinoza esoterically, as sort of trying to make sense of his numerous contradictions, but also in stressing the importance of the theological political treatise. The vast majority of Spinoza scholarship, which is generally happens in philosophy departments rather than political science departments, which is a whole other issue, but the vast majority of Spinoza scholarship really gives priority to the ethics as sort of Spinoza's most mature philosophy, and then they'll sort of look back on I'm generalizing here, but look back on the theological political treatise as kind of, you know, early work in which Spinoza kind of just gave his thoughts on superstition and so forth, and thoughts on politics, but the real thing is the ethics. But the way I read it following Strauss is that it's kind of the opposite way, that we should read the theological political treatise as sort of the foundation of everything, because it really seriously takes up the question of are there miracles? Do we have to guide, and if so, do we have to guide our life by those who claim divine inspiration, which would be the greatest miracle? And the ethics begins by just accepting that there are no miracles, that Spinoza calls God is immanent in nature, we could call all the laws of nature God. And that this is the real God, not the biblical God. So that in a way, it presupposes a authentic confrontation with revelation, which I believe Spinoza is trying to do in the theological political treatise. So I consider that work foundational. I tried in the book, I tried to tread a bit lightly there because my book doesn't really study the ethics in any detail. And that's partly for reasons of space, but also partly because the ethics is a very difficult book. So I don't deny the importance of the ethics by any means. And a lot more could be said and a lot more complications to my arguments could probably be raised by reading the ethics. But that's one of the main differences is my stress on the theological political treatise.
Okay, good. So let's talk about that book. You have two chapters on it. And the theological political treatise, you know, it's a book that has a negative aim and a positive aim. That is, the negative aim, it's quite clearly a critique of the Bible and one of the most famous critiques of the Bible in the modern era. But it also is, it has this aim, as you said, of putting forward and defending a vision of an ideal form of liberal democracy. So maybe you could start by talking a little bit about Spinoza's, critique of religion. What's his general strategy, and what are the kind of limitations or contradictions that you see in that critique?
Yeah, that's a big question. That Spinoza, the beginning, the very first line of the theological political treatise is that if human beings could regulate all their affairs with certain counsel, or if fortune were always favorable to them, they would not be bound by any superstition. And from there, Spinoza begins an articulation of what he calls superstition, based on as sort of a natural product arising from fear and ignorance, and it very much follows the same kind of logic that for example, Hobbes gives in chapter 12 of Leviathan. But from there, he articulates a kind of description of a moral outlook which religion leads to, which he calls devotion, namely the dedication to something greater than oneself, which goes together with an outlook he calls admiration. I mean, these are two terms which, and this is a big contrast with classical political thought, for example. So far as I know, those two terms are always used pejoratively. He often calls admiration foolish wonder. And so from there, we get a description of the way in which the desire for these worldly goods, what Spinoza calls goods of fortune, which can be constantly frustrated because one is not pursuing them with any kind of scientific rigor, can lead ultimately to, first of all, to the political exploitation by those who are using that, manipulating superstition for their own purposes, but then also to a kind of robust challenge to rationalism itself. In the way Spinoza puts this is that people call reason blind because it can't show them the way to the vain things they long for. So from this ordinary problem of human misfortune, I lost my money in a bad investment that must have been the work of some god or some invisible power, you get a kind of robust theory according to which reason itself is not an authority we should listen to and is even a deceitful authority. So in a way, this sort of sets the task. That's, I think, my argument in the book is that Spinoza takes that challenge to reason itself quite seriously and seeks to vindicate reason in part by addressing himself to that, addressing this moral difference between his view of the world and that which is typical of religious belief, which he calls devotion.
Yeah. So is the account, I mean, it sounds a little bit like Nietzsche's sort of slave morality kind of account, I mean, of yeah. religion. That is that, so religious belief emerges from a kind of, from misfortune, I guess is the way you put it, misfortune, suffering in the world, which arouses a kind of fear and a sense of lack of agency in the world. And then, so we posit these gods that give us a sense of power and then we close off our own, we sort of give sort of blind loyalty to them because questioning them could sort of undermine their power over the world and over us. Is that Is that roughly the account?
I think so. I don't know. Yeah, that'd be a good question to think about what the difference is between his account and Nietzsche's account of resentment in giving rise to religion. Yeah,
but it is, you know, his account goes beyond Hobbes in this element of, as you say, kind of admiration, right? So yeah. how does that emerge on Spinoza's view? Like how does it get, where does he think Hobbes goes wrong in that account?
I don't think that he thinks Hobbes goes wrong. I think he and Hobbes are very similar in the way they view the origins of religion. But one thing Spinoza stresses, which Hobbes doesn't stress too much of, is a kind of anthropocentrism, of which a belief in teleology would be a prime example of that sort of primary feature of superstition is the belief that human beings are at the center of everything, and everything in nature is somehow oriented towards our use. And Spinoza juxtaposes that to the what he calls the philosophic outlook, which is a kind of belief in the lack of status, or knowledge, I should say, of the lack of special status that human beings have in the universe. He just says we're just a particle of nature. It's odd, and I think deeply paradoxical, something I still struggle to get my head around, because he also says that's our summum bonum, that's our greatest good, is that's the culmination of human dignity, is recognizing that there is no such cosmic support for human dignity. That's in a way maybe more tension ridden than Hobbes.
I mean, could you say a little bit more about, I mean, this is I think a core element here, in the sense that, you know, so if Spinoza is a defender of the philosophical life as a summum bonum, it sounds a lot like the ancients, yeah. right? But
yeah.
the core difference here, I think, is on this point, which is a very different conception of nature. The ancients conceived of nature as a sort of teleologically and hierarchically ordered whole. Spinoza sort of destroys that. You know, adapts something of modern scientific, you know, non-teleological efficient causation only. Yeah. So how does that, I mean, I guess changing view of nature sort of in you know, the sort of thing he inherits, I guess, from Hobbes and from other Descartes, Bacon, mm-hmm. the early modern period, sort of inflect yeah. his critique of religion yeah. and his view yeah. here.
It's one of those things that I think makes him really interesting, that he tries to preserve, he's been called the last of the medievals as well as the first of the moderns, that he tries to maintain this you know, view of that there is such a thing as a summum bonum or finis ultimus. There is human, he uses those terms all the time. There is a kind of human excellence that is available to human beings, but not other beings. But he argues for that on the plane of the modern non-teleological universe that he's very much, you know, Spinoza wrote his first work on Descartes. He's very much indebted to Descartes. And he sort of in a way tries to, I think the way I put it in the book is something like achieve the ends of classical idealism on the plane of modern realism. And it raises a number of questions, right? How can one have, as I was saying before, how can one have a view of human excellence, which is quite literally founded on the idea that on a liberation from the belief in that excellence, because believing that you know, in a way that human beings have some kind of special dignity in the universe is an anthropocentric view that the way that the universe exists so that we can flourish. And in a way, Spinoza says we flourish paradoxically when we realize that there is no gravity, that we're just you know, matter in motion. Although I misspoke a little bit there, because Spinoza, I think, he makes very clear in the Ethics he's not quite a materialist, but which is another thing I think makes him pretty interesting.
Yeah, and I'm going to get to that in a minute, sort of his pantheism, because at least there's a connection with Tocqueville there, and Tocqueville has a fair bit to say about pantheism. But okay, yeah, I mean, this is you know, at this point, I mean, just to, you know, summarize in a way that, I mean, I take it one of the things Spinoza is saying here, right, is that he's challenging the Bible in a distinct way to somebody like Hobbes on the ground of that it fails to realize human potential in a way, right, that its vision of human excellence is not as high as Spinoza's, right, that it enchains reason rather than liberating it. And so, you know, the life of reason is the highest sort of life in the Bible is in the sort of political community that's rooted in the Bible fails to realize that view. Okay. So, I mean, that seems pretty, you know, straightforward in a certain way, but maybe you could walk us through some of the sort of complications and contradictions you see, because it seems like a straightforward Enlightenment kind of account, right? That, you know, the religion is, you know, benighted and forecloses human freedom. And, you know, here's the promise of a new, you know, new view of reason that liberates us. And then a political community, which provides the political analog of freedom. So where do you see this sort of complications coming in Spinoza's theological political treatise?
Yeah, well, I mean, you've summarized that very well. I think, you know, part of the complication is the way that, you know, obviously Spinoza doesn't just say that, though he does say that at times, but he also says the opposite. He tries to present throughout the book, he puts on stage certain biblical figures, especially Solomon and Paul, as sort of Spinozist living within the time of the Bible. And he even calls Solomon the philosopher at one point. But then he also contradicts that on occasions. He calls Solomon a prophet, and then he says the prophets are by definition those who are not so strong in reason. And so there's a kind of, the way I interpret the book is that he takes the reader on through stages, that he's trying to bring about enlightenment of, first of all, sort of the most elite of his readers. He says that he wrote the book for those who would philosophize more freely if this one thing didn't stand in their way, that reason has to serve as the handmaiden to theology. So on the one hand, he's trying to sort of take to reach sort of the most gifted of his readers, but who would embrace a full life of reason, but are held back by the lingering suspicion that the stuff in the Bible might be true. Maybe not literally true in terms of the mirror, in terms of, you know, the age of the earth and so on, but they might feel this sort of tug of devotion to something greater than themselves. There's a kind of moral, you know, difference between life in a Spinozistic liberal democracy and life lived according to biblical principles. And so I think Spinoza's trying to talk to that reader especially. But then also to sort of move society along as far as it can go towards approximating that view. And I don't think Spinoza himself may not be sure how far it can go. He may leave that as an open question. So along the way, he's got to kind of bring, you know, throw life rafts and you know, and build structures and then demolish the structures, to kind of mix my metaphors. And so to do that, he contradicts himself a lot. So he'll present Paul as a kind of kind of philosopher, or Solomon as a philosopher, who is a kind of biblical model, and with the proviso that therefore, you know, God is teaching, the message that God is teaching you, that God agrees with Spinoza, but then he'll show that that's obviously not the case, and that Paul was in certain respects quite the irrationalist. And this becomes especially true if you look up the passages that Spinoza is citing to justify this.
Yeah, so is this, it's a rhetorical project in a way, right?
I think it's a rhetorical and an educational project.
Yeah, right, educational, right? So that it's, because if you're trying to enlighten, I guess, a benighted people in Spinoza's view, you can't just tell them that everything that they're saying, that they've believed in since childhood is nonsense.
Yeah. Yeah, there's probably nothing worse you could do.
Right. You have to sort of walk them through up a ladder, I guess, as it were, where you sort of employ some of the dogmatic elements of the tradition and then kind of subtly undermine them. Is that that's your sense of what's going on?
Yeah, that's my argument in the book, is that we can see that this the theological political treatise is structured as a preface in 20 chapters, and I take the preface as Spinoza outlining, here's what I'm going to do and why do I have to do it. And then the 20 chapters begins the 20 chapters can be seen as steps in this project of religious and cultural transformation. And so we're that proceeds on two levels, as we're moving sort of the most elite reader from a reliance on the Bible to a reliance on reason alone. We're also doing the same thing at a popular level, or social level with the fall of society. And so what's appropriate for someone at chapter or stage one might be very different than, or sorry, what's appropriate for someone at chapter or stage 20 may be very different from what you get in chapter or stage one.
Right. Yeah. Because I found this fascinating. There's sort of two different audiences of the book. That is a kind of, you know, there's a sort of esoteric, you know, approach and an exoteric approach. It's speaking to, you know, those who could be the next philosophers after Spinoza, but also speaking to the many, as it were. But there's a tension between those two. I thought maybe you could speak to this, because this is one of the, I take one of the sort of deepest tensions here at the heart of this, because Spinoza, you know, argues that in order for a kind of liberal democracy to maintain itself, it requires a, I don't know, for lack of a better word, it's kind of like an ideological prop or support in order to maintain loyalty to the regime, which comes at cross purposes with the sort of cultivation of skeptical reason. So we could talk about that and what your how you work that out in Spinoza's view.
Yeah. So the book begins in the preface by saying, you know, it's as impossible to take away superstition from people as it is to take away dread or fear. And he regards superstition as necessary because there's always going to be human misfortune, right? People are going to be diagnosed with cancer and you don't understand why. And so they're going to have recourse to some kind of divine explanation. And of course, the whole societies, he suggests, societies need people to make sacrifices. And so there needs to be sort of popular myths undergirding those sacrifices. I think Spinoza, in a way, would be very similar to the ancients on that, or at least he seems to say that. But then at the very end, so he starts by saying that it's as impossible to take away superstition as it is to take away fear or dread. But then at the very end, when he's articulating his vision of liberal democracy, he says the whole point of this regime is to free each person from dread, kind of a regime without fear, which suggests maybe you could have no more religion or no more superstition. And he articulates a teaching of natural right, which he says suggests a kind of moral basis for a liberal democratic society, which is based on reason alone. And just to sort of make a long story short, without providing any evidence for this rather big claim, I think that itself is a myth. It's a kind of another version or second stage of the civil religion, which he articulates earlier in the book. If you sort of scrutinize closely what he says reason teaches, this popular religious teaching in chapter 20, it turns out to be something of an ideology, although one with which is friendlier to reason because it masquerades as reason. And the hope is, I think Spinoza's hope or expectation or confidence is that it will, on the one hand, undergird those sacrifices that all societies need in order to survive and to prosper, but also because it does take its bearings by reason and admire reason and look up to reason, it will motivate the best and the brightest, you know, students in the universities to really take that last step and think through even this what you could call ideology or kind of rationalistic myth and make the final step to an embrace of reason itself.
Yeah, so it seems like this at this moment is sort of your biggest claim about Spinoza. And maybe you can say a little bit more, because I don't know if I was totally convinced at this point, which is, you know, roughly that Spinoza, you know, he claims to base liberal democracy on reason alone, but your claim is that he really kind of doesn't truly believe that. Like, you can't actually base liberal democracy on reason alone, because something like natural rights isn't, you know, grounded in reason. Do I have that right? And maybe you could just say a little bit about how you, you know, kind of maybe say a little bit more about what the evidence is that you to arrive at that conclusion.
Yeah. Well, Spinoza is quite explicit, and, you know, you might even say irresponsible in the way that he presents the insights of reason, which is that it gives sole priority, or not just priority, but sole emphasis to the self-interest of the rational individual. And he says this is why you need a civil religion, because otherwise, in his terms, no one will ever obey. No one will ever obey. A truly rational person will never obey the law because it's the law. He or she will only obey the law because the law happens to coincide with his or her individual self-interest. And so there's no, you know, that. And then he says in an annotation that people who are guided by reason don't really see rights, this moral claim that Spinoza seeks to purports to find in nature, that he says, and it is his teaching on natural right is strange. He says that in a way it's more radical than Hobbes's. He says not only do you have a right to do whatever you find necessary or even want to do in the state of nature, but he even extends that morality to inanimate objects or animals. He says the biggest fish eat the small fish by the highest natural right. So whatever happens in nature, that happens justly. And I think I read that in the book as a kind of moral approximation. He's sort of superimposing moral categories onto what is a world of amoral, deterministic natural necessities. But in doing that, he's providing a kind of philosophical or a kind of a moral approximation or impersonation of the way philosophers view the world, and trying to make that the basis for his envisioned liberal republic.
So there's no like law of nature, laws of nature like there are in Hobbes and Spinoza?
No, not in the same way. One interesting difference between Hobbes and Spinoza is that Hobbes, you know, in Spinoza, you don't leave the state of nature because the state of nature is just nature. It's just you're and we are always subject to natural necessities and natural laws. And so it's somewhat complicated, but in that way, he uses the state of nature as a kind of, he appeals to it as a positive standard at times, that it's a kind of standard for freedom under government.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a sort of pervasively egoistic view. It's hard to understand how you could get from sort of universal egoism to some commitment to rights, because that requires a sense of duty and selflessness. So I see your point.
And I think that's there's one thing that both Hobbes and Spinoza they both use the same example. Hobbes says, what if you are accosted by a thief and he puts a gun to your head and says, give me all your money, and you say I don't have any money, and then the thief says, well, come back tomorrow and we'll go to the ATM together, and you say okay and you leave. Do you have an obligation to actually do this, or can you just run away or turn him in? And Hobbes says you absolutely do. You have to make a contract. You made a contract with this thief, and so you have to do this, because otherwise he's going to shoot the next person. And Spinoza takes that same example and says, no, you don't have to do that, right? And he says, no one will ever promise without a ruse to yield his right to all things. And the way I read that in the book is that there is a kind of liberal democratic morality is kind of a ruse or a swindle to Spinoza, it's a superstition we make this social contract, and one thing the social contract promises is that there's going to be a harmony between my good and society's good. And I think the rational person, as Spinoza understands him, and he's quite explicit about this, is that there is ultimately in the long run not such a harmony. Now, in a liberal democracy, one of its great advantages is that harmony will exist to the greatest extent possible. The times where there will be the real tension will be minimal. Hopefully it'll be a pacific society, a commercial society. There won't be too many wars, and therefore too many occasions where self-sacrifice is going to be required. But there's still, every society needs policemen and soldiers and people who put their lives on the line, and also make other small sacrifices, like paying your taxes and so on. You have to know that that's good for you. So Spinoza looks to a teaching of natural right to undergird this. But I think that Spinoza, in contrast to Hobbes, is aware that is less than fully rational, ultimately.
Right. So a society of philosophers actually wouldn't work ultimately on this view, right? If you actually had a followed out Spinoza's logic and everyone became philosophers, the society wouldn't hold together.
Well, actually, he says it would. He says that there society would need no laws in that case, because everybody would basically seek out what's really good for them, and there wouldn't be much, being all philosophers, they wouldn't be that interested in taking each other's money, for example, because they don't need that much money. The problem is that actually society is quite unreasonable. People pursue what he calls these goods of fortune with excessive desire, and that there's where the problem enters.
I see. Right. So natural rights is a sort of it's an ideological doctrine that's, again, like this sort of educative rhetorical technique to get people from a state of unreason and benightedness to a state of rationality, right?
Yeah, and that's my
take the latter away. And I
do make that claim in the book, and I suspect that will be a controversial claim in Spinoza's scholarship that the natural right is kind of a further stage of it's a kind of civil religion, although it's a religion in which God is not entirely absent, but he's sort of, because it's also divine right, he says, but it's God is kind of taken a back seat. But it's not an entirely rational doctrine. And, you know, at the conclusion of the Spinoza section, I sort of wonder out loud about whether that has had some effect, that we're living in an era where, you know, the teaching on natural right is you know, not something you hear about anymore from most leading public intellectuals. It's not as authoritative as it was at the origin of our country. And there's even a dissatisfaction with reason itself. And what we have is a contest between different ideologies. And I wonder in the book whether, you know, Spinoza is in certain ways responsible for that. If the foundation of liberal democratic society is a kind of superstition that claims to be rational, does that eventually morph into a world in which, you know, the universities are filled with different competing superstitions or isms, which all claim to be rational, and then that can lead to a certain kind of dissatisfaction with reason, or the thought that it's all kind of dogmatism all the way down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wanted to conclude the Spinoza discussion with. You identify a couple of problems, of which this is one of them that you're just speaking of now. I wanted to focus, maybe you could say just a little bit on the psychological aspect of, you know, the sort of way in which, in your view, you know, Spinoza denies or abstracts from, eliminates the sort of religious longing, I guess, from the biblical view. I ask this because I think here's another way in which the ethics could come back in, and I wanted to propose this to you as a way to think about it. Okay, so, you know, if Spinoza sort of focuses on reason alone and misses the sort of transcendent elements in human life and the longing for immortality that's characteristic of it, but then he follows up the theological political treatise later with the ethics, where, you know, it's not a materialistic view, as you said, but it's a pantheistic view, where, you know, the religious longing does actually come back in. So I guess that's what I'm wondering is you know, if you wrote a sequel to the book and examined the ethics, would you come to a different conclusion here about the sort of deficiency in Spinoza's view about his attention to our religious psychology?
Yeah, I mean, Spinoza, the foundation of Spinoza's psychology is this thing called conatus, that everybody strives to persevere in their being. And he doesn't mean this just in the sort of Hobbesian sense of we want to stay alive, but he says everything wants to persevere in its state. So to use his examples, you know, cats want to be cats. Wise people want to be wise people. Fools want to be fools. And human beings want to be human beings. That implies that we want to keep going. We want to survive. But he also sees this, and this is one thing that makes Spinoza really interesting, he conceives of self-preservation in a kind of much richer sense, they say, than Hobbes does. It's not just a matter of maintaining our physical existence. Although I think, I can't prove it here, but I think that Hobbes would, I mean, Spinoza would not believe in that he doesn't accept kind of dualism, that the mind is just apart from the body. But be that as it may, that the fundamental drive that we have is to remain in our being, remain being as we are. So that means that nobody wants to be greater than themselves. We don't want to be gods. And we also don't want to sacrifice ourselves. We don't want to become less than we are. We don't have disgust for existence, is the way Tocqueville puts it. And so he, you know, the, to Spinoza, self-sacrifice is, strictly speaking, impossible. That, yes, communities may need people to give up certain good things for the good of the community, but that's why they need superstition. They need to be taught that this is good for them. And so in a way, that I think is where the chief way in which Spinoza is different than the classics. It's the way in which he's certainly different than the Bible, and also different from Tocqueville, as I interpret Tocqueville. As to the question of, you know, how would the ethics complicate things? That's a good question. Certainly Spinoza's most famous for this teaching of pantheism, but I don't think that the ethics would my suspicion is the ethics wouldn't change much. This idea of Conatus as foundational to the way human psychology is, and therefore to everything we want, and his account of the various effects and the passions is all based on this. I see the way I interpret the pantheism is basically one big part of Spinoza's use of superstition in order to kind of build a kind of what you could call kind of elite superstition to allow kind of those who have or believe themselves to have been liberated from religion in general, and especially biblical religion in particular, to sort of still maintain a belief that there's something out there that supports their activity, that supports human dignity, and therefore it ultimately does cater to a kind of anthropocentrism, which Spinoza would regard as ultimately, in the last analysis, superstitious.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I can see that. I mean, and there is often, I mean, it sounds to me a sort of right. You know, there's some readings of Spinoza as an atheist, right?
This yeah.
is very popular, yeah. which it sounds to me like what you're driving at. I mean, another approach to,
yes.
to it would be to take right. Yeah. would be to take it more seriously. And again, let me tempt you with the Germans. I mean, a lot of the German thinkers who were themselves followers of Spinoza took the pantheistic theory seriously. And I mean, at least one of the advantages of it, it's a form of immanent divinity. That is, that there's a sort of spark of divinity in all of us that persists in within our being. And that, you know, when we are born and when we die, that the divinity is not sort of it's transcendent, but it's a sort of imminent conception. But in any case, I'm not sure. I mean, maybe at the end of the day, it doesn't make a difference, but at least there's that. I mean, it is interesting that at least he has to refer to that he's at least aware. I mean, I guess my point is he's at least aware of that need, that human need, and maybe it's just an atavistic need that he wants to ultimately get rid of, but he is aware of that psychological need.
Yeah. That's the question I've wrestled with. Does Spinoza think that there's a psychological need to be a part of something greater than oneself and to lose oneself into something greater than oneself? Because he sometimes does seem to write that way. And the pantheism, it isn't only in the ethics, it is in the theological political treatise as well. Like in the chapter on miracles, he says that at one point, he says that nature contains infinite things besides matter. You can get a picture there of a kind of enchanted universe. Where he says that we know God better on the basis of a deterministic, naturalistic universe than you would if there were miracles, because then you wouldn't be certain of anything. And on that basis, he makes the rather ridiculous claim that if you believe in miracles, you're an atheist. But there's something to what you say that when Spinoza. When the theological political treatise was first published, the universal reaction was to condemn it as a work of atheism. About a century later, Spinoza came to be called a God-intoxicated man, in Novalis's famous phrase. Spinoza's reputation in Germany, I think, has been more. I'm not an authority on this, but I think it's been more along those lines, as you say. That if you read the ethics, you know, God is everywhere. Everything is literally in God.
Right.
And that comes through in the theological political treatise as well. But I think, you know, if you read it carefully, and again, I don't do it in the book, so I would need to say more here. But, you know, just looking, for example, you mentioned that there's a teaching at the end of the ethics that the mind is eternal, or rather more precisely, he says something of the mind is eternal and outlives the body. But then he's very clear in that doesn't mean that consciousness continues after death.
Right. Yeah, good. And as I mentioned, you know, Tocqueville has a number of things to say about pantheism too. So maybe we can get around to that. Yeah. So let's turn to Tocqueville. I thought maybe we could start with Tocqueville, but I guess similarly where we did with Spinoza, if you could talk a little bit about the scholarship, which is quite a bit in political science as opposed to in Spinoza. But maybe say a little bit about the scholarship sort of where your Tocqueville differs from others.
Yeah, I think so. Here I have to say, I mean, I do have a lot of debts that I hope I paid in the book. A lot of the scholarship on Tocqueville was really good, and so there's a lot of good, thoughtful, reflective scholarship on democracy in America, and also a lot of popular writing as well. And you know, the thing is about Tocqueville is he's it's such a big book. And Democracy in America, and it's one of those books that kind of has been all things to all people, both inside and outside the academy. And it's a book sort of like the Bible, where one can find a reputation, find an answer to whatever position you want to argue for. And so I think that there's been some of that at the scholarly level there's debates about exactly where a lot of the scholarship on Tocqueville is sort of trying to figure out where to pin Tocqueville down. Like, is he an early modern who admires Hobbes and Locke and wants to continue their project? Or there's a famous letter that Tocqueville wrote where he said, "I live a little every day with Pascal, Montesquieu, and Rousseau." And so there's a lot of scholarship tries to say, well, he's a Pascalian, or he's a Montesquieuan, or he's a Rousseauian. Of course, he can't be all three of those things, because those three thinkers disagree but pretty fundamentally on certain things. And so my contribution is that my approach has been to just try to let Tocqueville speak for himself. And not to reduce him to sort of one school of thought or another. I'm not saying that all Tocqueville scholarship does that. That's certainly not true. But I wanted to sort of be sensitive to that. There's always a temptation in Tocqueville to sort of make him say what you want him to say. And for some reason, he's one of these thinkers who lends himself to this, because he writes in a kind of haphazard way. There's probably about 50 things in Democracy in America that he says are the most important thing you have to know when reading the book. And so I've tried to isolate what he calls the mother thought, what is the thread that seems to be uniting all these disparate elements. And I found this, or I think I found this, in what he calls his religious psychology, and this description of why human beings believe what they believe, and what leads human beings to faith, and also the way that psychology exists in a world in which religion is on the decline. So I've sought to sort of center that. There was one particular paragraph in volume one, which I make a lot out of, but I describe a kind of complicated psychology according to which human beings seek to both affirm themselves and forget themselves, that they try to seek out a kind of happiness that is found kind of paradoxically in a concern for self-sacrifice. And so I hope that the contribution of the book is to draw attention to that element of Tocqueville's thought and the way that it underlies his concern with the place of the human soul in modern liberal democratic conditions, which are also secularizing conditions.
Yeah, it seems to me you're on the side of, I mean, if there's a divide between the Tocquevillians who think that there is such a thing as human nature, and the Tocquevillians who are historicists, you're much more on the side of the human nature side. That is, that there is a sort of core human needs, namely religious needs. I mean, I think of your Tocqueville as somewhat of a religious intoxicated man, I have to say. That there are, you know, religious needs that sort of animate things that are sort of at the core of his project. But in any case, I mean, let's start with your, I mean, the way you proceed is by talking about Tocqueville's critique of the Enlightenment. I mean, as you mentioned before, Tocqueville is writing quite a bit later than Spinoza. The Enlightenment project is, much further along than when Spinoza was himself writing. And so Tocqueville's responding to developments of liberal democracy in the 19th century. So how does he stand towards his Enlightenment predecessors? There's a kind of ambivalence there. Maybe you could talk a little bit about it. How does he stand towards this sort of Spinozist project?
Yeah, well, I mean, hostile to Spinoza, to say the least. But it's interesting because it's complicated. I mean, I think Tocqueville's friendly and sympathetic to the Enlightenment. And that's the first thing to note, that I would regard Tocqueville as a friendly critic of the Enlightenment. That he says at one point that if he had been born in an aristocratic century, he would have encouraged the study of the physical sciences in order to increase prosperity and well-being. And I take that as a sign of genuine sympathy. On the other hand, I think it's clear that Tocqueville thinks that the Enlightenment missed something crucial in the way they understood the human soul, or the way they didn't understand there being a human soul. And to go back to what I was saying at the beginning of our conversation, that the idea that of religion's origins as rooted in poverty and ignorance and oppression, that this is something that Tocqueville says that the philosophers of the 18th century expected the gradual weakening of religious beliefs, that as freedom and enlightenment increased, they thought that churches would empty. And I think Tocqueville thinks, on the surface, it looks like, you know, they've been certainly, Tocqueville says that they were wrong about that. And I think there's various, Tocqueville goes back and forth in providing an impression of why they were wrong. But I think ultimately that he thinks they missed something in terms of why human beings believe and what the roots of religion are. That there is a certain longing in the human soul for eternity, and that's mixed up with a desire for self-sacrifice or self-abnegation. And because they didn't see that, this part of human nature, they sort of left it uncontrolled and undirected, is my thesis in the book, that they didn't see this as existing. And so there was all of a sudden, as a result, this kind of wild card, this part of human nature that didn't have any kind of apparatus to channel it in a healthy direction. And Tocqueville, I think, devoted his new, what he calls his new political science, to trying to remedy that oversight.
Yeah, so maybe say a little bit about the consequences, I guess, of the oversight of this longing in the human soul. I mean, one of the interesting things about your project is you sort of revisit some familiar features of democracy in America, you know, some of the main problems in democracy in America: individualism, tyranny of the majority, and self-despotism, and so forth. But sort of read them in light of this engagement with the Enlightenment. So maybe you could say a little bit about, you know, some of these problems with that Tocqueville identifies with democracy through this lens of the Enlightenment's blindness to religion.
Yeah. So one example would be his famous account of his famous chapter on why the Americans are so restive in the midst of their well-being. One thing I tell my students is, you know, America is the place with the most rich people who are the most unhappy, and that's a seeming paradox, right? Why would that be? Tocqueville, you know, he catalogs these interesting anecdotes about Americans sort of doing things that are crazy. It would seem that they take needless risks. He describes an American sailor who travels halfway around the world under the most, you know, arduous conditions, and all to sell a pound of tea for a penny less than his British counterpart. And the Americans take just these tremendous risks, these tremendous self-sacrifices, all to make a buck. And, you know, the way I interpret that is that there's a kind that that's an area in which this longing for they're tormented by the memory of death, that their life is short, but they don't kind of have an adequate way of dealing with that problem, and so they sort of like seek to, you know, get more and more wealth as though that will do anything, but they, as a kind of solution to that problem, but then that solution obviously proves inadequate, but they don't have any other way of remedying that, so they do the same thing again. They engage in the same behavior over and over again while expecting a different result, and then that leads to certain kind of pathologies or anomalies in the human soul, which I think Tocqueville's account of what I call his religious psychology can help us account for.
I mean it's interesting, and I mean I find that, you know, a suggestive kind of reading. I mean, it reminds me a little bit of Hobbes and the sort of restlessness of the desire for power. But at the same time, I mean, there's also, I mean, I guess a Rousseau type reading of this same phenomenon, which is, well, why we're so restive is not because we want to you know, try to escape death, but it's because we're clamoring to express our status and our achieve a kind of self-love because of our amor prop pushes us mm-hmm. to, you know, assert our honor above everything. So it's a kind of really, you know, in other words, this is sort of a relational view that's mm-hmm. sort of mediated by the condition of democracy in which everybody's equal, but yet we desire to be more, we desire to be better than other people. So, yeah, I mean, I guess that's how I typically, I mean, that's why I find surprising your reading, like mm-hmm. that it's rooted rather in a sort of more fundamental, but it strikes me that this is, you know, some way a kind of aristocratic rendering of a democratic phenomenon. And I'm not sure if it, I'm totally convinced, I guess.
Might be, yeah. I mean, he says about this longing for equality, which is one of the most pernicious things that he says. And I guess it's possible to read that chapter as, you know, as very much Tocqueville the aristocrat. But he says that we're Americans are or Democrats with a small D are attached to equality because it's something that will last forever. That it's something sort of lasting and permanent. And it has a seductiveness to it that there's a kind of sense that, you know, if you devote yourself to this thing that's greater than yourself, you lose yourself in it, but you'll also affirm yourself in doing that, but in a way, in a kind of very pernicious way, not in the way Christianity did, where it allowed you to elevate yourself and have a sense of your own dignity in a world with God, but in a way that sort of eradicates the individual. And I see that that's how I read his I see that this discussion of his longing for equality as a kind of foreshadowing of his description of life under soft despotism, in which the dignity of the individual will be totally eradicated, but it may come into being by, there's a kind of ambition for that. We long with all of our souls to bring into being this administrative nanny state where human beings are just like little peons walking around and being done favors by the government. There's a kind of strange mixture of a tremendous longing for a better world, but the better world that would result would be one in which human longings are almost totally diminished. So it, in a way, the way I put this in the book is that ambitions can turn in on themselves and destroy themselves.
Yeah, that's good. So you say a little bit about the sort of then Tocqueville's political science and how he, how your reading here helps us think about the measures that he puts in place to counteract these problems. I mean, religious, and there are a number of chapters that we're all familiar with and on his view of religion as, you know, tempering the democratic impulses, but you also have a number of different reflections on his Tocqueville's view of greatness and of honor. Mm-hmm. So maybe you could bring that in.
Yeah, that he's that. Sorry, let me get my train of thought here. There's a lot in that question. That you know what? That, so I think Tocqueville says at one point that the whole art of the legislator consists in discerning well and in advance what are the natural tendencies of human societies and when do you accelerate them and when do you slow them down. So I see that this is one, I think, one way in which I see Tocqueville as sort of not wedded to any regime, that he's not a democrat, he's not an aristocrat. He's simply saying, well, how do you maximize human greatness in the society in which you have to live in, and so he says that, in other words, if society is moving too much in one direction, prop it up a little bit in the other direction. It's one way in which, by the way, he recommends the study of Greek and Latin authors, because they prop us up on the side where we lean, that they sort of have a kind of healthy aristocratic counterbalance to these sort of excessive democratic tendencies. So that I see Tocqueville as kind of like, you know, he says at one point that a mixed regime doesn't really exist, that in every society there's one principle that dominates all the others. But that, of course, implies that there are others, they're minority influences, they're weaker influences, but they still have some influence nonetheless. And so I think Tocqueville sees the aim of his political science as seeking to cultivate those, you know, residual aristocratic influences that could still exist within a democracy. And Tocqueville, I think, indicates that if he were living in, you know, at the time of Louis XIV, he would have probably written a very different book if he would have been allowed to write that book. that he would, you know, he would have wanted to prop up aristocracy with various democratic elements. Well, now when democracy is the only moral principle that can be legitimately defended in public, when it's the generative fact, as he puts it, that gives birth to every other fact, one has to find ways to sort of reintroduce or at least preserve, where they haven't yet been destroyed, elements of aristocracy. And that's why Tocqueville says that religion especially should be preserved as the most precious inheritance from aristocratic centuries. That it's something, religion as he's describing it, is something particularly and maybe even strangely, given that we're talking about Christianity, aristocratic, and that it has to serve, but it's always going to serve as a kind of counterweight, a minority influence. It's never going to be the dominant feature of democratic society.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, this is good. I mean, I recognize these elements in Tocqueville. That is it strikes me, one of the things that you read in Tocqueville and read very well is the way in which Tocqueville looks for aristocratic elements that can still be preserved in a democratic age in order to counterbalance democracy's tendency towards leveling and mediocrity, in order to, you know, sort of set our sights higher and the aspiration for the sublime and whatnot. One of the things I wanted to ask you about, though, is that, again, I think this follows up on my last question about the sort of democratic Tocqueville. I mean, there's this other side to Tocqueville, obviously, which is, I guess you could call it, instead of his aristocratic democracy, you could say, you know, like a pragmatic, even Enlightenment Tocqueville, which is, you know, all his many solutions that revolve around social and political associations, mm-hmm. right? And this idea of self-interest rightly understood, which is not an aristocratic principle, right? It's an emphatically democratic principle that's used against itself, where you know, the idea is you just expand the scope of your concern and you have, you know, you get skin in the game by participating. I guess I'm curious about, you know, sort of what role that plays in your theory, because it seems to me that brings Tocqueville ultimately a lot closer to Spinoza than you're suggesting. What do you think?
Well, the way I interpret the self-interest well understood chapter, and this may be another difference between what I argue in the book and what some other scholarships that's out there, is I see self-interest well understood as, yes, it's a democratic ethos, it's a democratic moral theory, but it's, in a way, maybe it's going too far to say that it exists for an aristocratic end, but he says it turns self-interest against itself. That the idea of, for those who may not be familiar, the idea of self-interest well understood is the idea that if I sacrifice myself in some way, ultimately, somehow in the long run, you know, it'll pay off. There'll be a kind of benefit to me. It may not be apparent, but, you know, it's someone will pay it forward or something, or I'll ultimately benefit in some way. And so it's not, it's to be distinguished from the kind of Lockean or, you know, Randian theories, according to which greed is good, right? That if I, or the kind of modern economic justification, that if I, you know, do what's good for myself, society will benefit. That's not self-interest well understood. And Tocqueville in that chapter explicitly condemns that view. Self-interest well understood is an attempt to sort of reintroduce notions of self-sacrifice, which he says was the dominant idea in aristocratic moral thinking. That he says that he begins that chapter by saying that when the world was led by a few powerful and wealthy individuals, these people liked to form themselves a sublime idea of the duties of man. And they said that it was glorious to forget oneself and do good without self-interest, like God himself. And Tocqueville, in a way, says in democracy, it's the opposite. Everything is justified in terms of self-interest. You know, my students would be ashamed to say that they do things purely for the good of humanity. Right? It's only for their, you have to somehow say, well, and actually I'll get a job out of it or something. But Tocqueville sees these moralists who preach self-interest well understood. He doesn't say who they are. But he says they've in a way found a way to turn interest against itself. They've appealed to self-interest in a way that gives people a kind of a reason, a self-interested reason to make sacrifices, if that makes any sense. And it is highly paradoxical. But they think, well, you know, if I give myself, if I give over some of my time and effort on the weekend to you know, helping the homeless or something, or volunteering time in my community, or going to I sacrifice a weeknight to go to a local government meeting or a town hall meeting or something, I'm going to ultimately, that'll benefit me in the long run. And it may not, it may just be a myth. But it's a way, Tocqueville says that it on the one hand, it will, that can actually reignite these psychological engines, this kind of interesting dynamic between self-interest and self-sacrifice that that he says in a way is distinctive of what makes human beings tick and what characterizes a truly human soul. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, it's true that if there's going to be, you know, this is supposed to be a rational morality. So there has to be a visible payoff, right? That you know, no one's going to make, and for that reason, people are less likely to make really, truly grand sacrifices under this theory. The sacrifices are going to be smaller, and the resulting payoff is going to be clearer and probably even closer in time to the act, to the self-sacrificial action. So it does, it is democratic in that sense, that what's going to, the way Tocqueville puts it is what you're going to have is what I call in the book sort of solid and dignified middle class virtues, self-delay, self-denial, you know, volunteering time on the weekends, that sort of thing. Maybe not, you're less likely to get the kind of grand sacrifices and great, but also corresponding to that, these grand visions of one's own importance and one's own greatness that you would have had under aristocracy. So I don't know if that's a total, if that answers your question, or if I dodge the question.
No. I think that's good. I wanted to, you know, we're running short on time here, so I want to kind of get to the contemporary, you know, implications, or what Spinoza and Tocqueville would say about our contemporary era, and what you take to be the implications of your analysis for a contemporary era. Maybe the place to start just is, you know, I mean, you suggested a little bit earlier when we were kind of concluding with the Spinoza discussion that Spinoza, you know, one of the issues with Spinoza's has to do with this sort of the ideological elements that are in his view and the way in which that could kind of lead to undermine reason, and it could be partially responsible for our contemporary era. One of the things that struck me actually when you were talking about that, and I wanted to wait to bring it up until we talk about Tocqueville, is it strikes me that, you know, when I look around contemporary state of American politics, it strikes me that actually maybe what we need is more Spinoza and less Tocqueville. so let me say, and you tell me why I'm wrong about this, but it seems to me that one of the things that we've lost is a commitment to the Enlightenment. That is that, you know, a commitment to sort of judicious reasoning, the use of evidence, a commitment to a kind of like aspiration towards rationality, right? What we have instead is sort of dogmatic motivated reasoning in illiberalism on the left and the right. And, you know, Tocqueville, one of the issues with Tocqueville, at least in my view, is he says dogmatic reasoning's okay, right? You know, yeah, you pair this with the kind of religious instinct that you're focusing on in Tocqueville. And I kind of worry that, you know, Tocqueville, who seems to be the hero of your book, and you should tell me if I'm wrong about that, but Tocqueville actually might not be the way out of the situation we have in. We might need more Spinozist enlightenment. So why am I wrong about that?
I'm not sure you're totally wrong.
okay.
One of the things that really attracts me to Spinoza, especially today, is his robust defense of free speech and free thought. The whole point of a liberal society is of a democracy. It's a society in which each can say what he wants, say what he thinks, that everyone can speak freely, think what he wants and say what he thinks. This is the whole point. This is the whole point. It's all about intellectual freedom, and free speech is meant to serve the highest purposes, right? Free speech is just not about ordinary loudmouths. It's not about irresponsible political discourse on Facebook. It's not about pornography. It's not about expletives. It's about it's about the liberalism in the highest sense, which is the cultivation of the individual mind. And Spinoza would defend, I'm not sure about those things, but he would defend the freedom of ordinary loud mouths, because that protects the people doing more serious things and the highest things. And so I think that's a big part, that's a big case for Spinoza. It's one reason why I wanted to turn to Spinoza. And I would add to that also, one difference, and I mentioned this at the end of the book, one big difference between Spinoza and Tocqueville that I see is that Spinoza, although Spinoza really seeks to, as I interpret him, seeks to dispose of religion as a challenge, he seeks to refute the Bible, he seeks to make religion almost a thing of the past, or as much as he can, he is also very attentive to the challenge to reason that religion poses. And so I fault Spinoza a little bit for this, because in the sense that, he brought about a world in which religion was not a challenge. Now, that has good sides of it, right? If you're a religious minority or a free thinker, you're a lot safer today than you would have been in the past. So toleration is a good thing. And Spinoza, I think, should be saluted for bringing into being a tolerant world. And that's one reason why he's super popular right now. But Spinoza also is despite or because of that, he's aware of the challenge that religion poses. In a way, our society, which is indebted to his efforts, in a way, is not. Right? When I talk, I have a very hard time, just to speak personally, I have a very hard time teaching, when I teach the early moderns, I struggle to teach, sometimes to teach Hobbes or works like Locke's Letter Concerning Toleration, because I just find, maybe it's different for you in Texas, but I just find that my students have no understanding of what, or I should say very little understanding, with a few exceptions here and there, very little understanding of what serious religion is and what the Bible actually says. And so there's Spinoza, in a way, has brought about an alienation from traditional religion, which has good sides and bad sides. But he himself was very much aware of that challenge, in a way that Tocqueville actually, one could fault Tocqueville for not taking that so seriously. Tocqueville seems very concerned with the political side of religion, as a social question or as a political question. Do you need religion to undergird society, to undergird morality, even for the greatness of the human soul, which is itself a kind of utilitarian argument? But is Tocqueville himself concerned with the question, the most important question of, is religion true? I don't actually think you get too much of that in democracy in America, and I think that's a real point in Spinoza's favor. But I think you're right about our current atmosphere today as one of where of competing dogmas on the left and the right being thrown at each other, but I do think that Tocqueville, in a way, we all, in a way, these dogmas are all visions of a perfect world. And, one sees this in our politics on both sides. So often the perfect is the enemy of the good. Right? One has to achieve the ideal society or nothing at all. And so I end the book by saying Tocqueville can pave the way for a recovery of the political virtue of moderation, which we sorely lack today, because I think he's quite sober in the way he analyzes democracy. He's like the classics in this regard, that he takes these questions of justice seriously. He takes the dogma seriously, as part in a way that, Aristotle says at one point that both democrats and aristocrats and oligarchs capture part of justice, but not the whole of justice. I think that's very Tocquevillian as well, that he sees that there are some ways in which democracy is the most just society that's ever existed, because he really believes human beings are morally equal. But there's other ways in which democracy is terribly unjust, because it can stifle the excellence of truly great people. And so I think he leads to a kind of sobriety about what we can hope for or expect for from politics. So that's my argument at any rate, which is can sort of lead to the beginning of a recovery of this idea of compromise and accepting accepting less than we can get, and therefore political moderation, sort of tempering our, more fundamentally than any political outcome, but tempering our hopes, our moral hopes for what we think democracy should offer us.
Okay, well, let's hope. Let's hope for that aspiration to come true. Great place to end. Aaron, this has been really fun. I really enjoyed our conversation. So thanks again for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.